As Executive Vice President for Health Affairs at U of L, he provides leadership for the university's Health Sciences Center and the schools of dentistry, medicine, nursing, public health, information services, as well as 14 health science centers and institutes, all which fall under the oversight of the Executive VP for Health Affairs, which David is. He also serves as a key member of President Jim Ramsey's leadership team, and he has the principal responsibility for the external affairs, including hospital relations and other affiliated entities. And Dr. Dunn and I were also deeply involved in the creation of the Kentucky One Health thing, which has approximately 20,000 employees and about, I forget how many facilities in the state of Kentucky, maybe 80. So, Dr. Dunn, I'm deeply honored to introduce you tonight and deeply honored to be before you scholars here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob. Really appreciate the kind introduction, and I'd just like to echo your comments in return. It's been an absolute pleasure working with you. I can tell you, having worked with a number of board chairs, there are some who are, shall I say, dictatorial. There are some who are not engaged. Bob is neither of those. He's exactly the opposite. He's the best board chair I've ever worked with because he's so engaged and really wants to see the U of L flourish. And that's what I want to see, too, since I've come there a little under 3 years ago. I'm deeply honored to be able to give this lecture. I didn't realize what it was when I first got the email, and then I began reading about Murray State University, the folks here, the facilities, and really the history. And it's a pretty amazing history in this part of Kentucky to have a jewel in the crown here like you do. You students and your families must be very proud. For those of you who are studying here, soon to graduate, I know, and I congratulate all of you in that regard. Now, I'm not a health policy wonk, if you will. You know, this isn't an area where I've extensively published. I have published in the area, but it's an area that I work in every day, and it is a really tough area right now. You folks are experts or becoming experts in political science and sociology, dealing with the issues that we face as a society here in the United States, but also worldwide, because we live in a global environment now. The world really is flat. And that's one of the things that really struck me when I thought about what I would talk to you about tonight. Because I would challenge you to find an area that is more politically and more sociologically charged than healthcare in the United States right now. We've got all sorts of other issues that you know, float by on CNN.com every day, but every day there's healthcare literally at the top of the list. I also thought about what I might tell you that I thought in the end would probably be a bit of hubris and overweening, which was to tell you about all the problems of healthcare and then tell you how I thought we could fix them. And instead, what I'm going to do is take a chapter from a number of areas that I guess I would characterize as what's wrong with healthcare in the United States, and hopefully entertain you a bit. Not in a very happy way, because the statistics are not particularly happy things to discuss. They're pretty disturbing, particularly here in the Commonwealth. But then tell you what I know a lot about, which is how academic health science centers are trying to solve some of these problems. And then tell you, as Bob alluded to, a story of how health science centers in the academy can't go it alone anymore. They have for ages, because we've been so well funded federally and often through the states, but the genesis of the University of Louisville and University Medical Center trying to find a health system partner, broaden our reach across the Commonwealth, which ended up being our partnership with Kentucky One. It's actually a pretty interesting business transaction to look at. And I was fortunate enough to be charged by the Board of Trustees, with Bob becoming chair at that point, to negotiate that transaction. And one of the things that happened is I actually got offered a job by a Manhattan firm. I think they were kidding, though. But they were the firm that we brought in to help us with some of the background work. Now, for those of you who were either a physics fan, which I'm not really, or science fiction fans, you might know what an event horizon is. In fact, there was a movie starring Larry Fishburne and Sam Neill that didn't receive a lot of acclaim, but it was an interesting movie because it was based solely on that concept. And what an event horizon is, I'm a Wikipedia fan, as some of you may be. It actually is a term in physics. Nobody knows whether it really exists or not, but in quantum and theoretical physics, it's the point where gravity and light are being sucked in to a black hole to the point where you really can't tell if anything's moving, and the people who have already been sucked in can't see out, and the people who are being sucked in can't see in. And the analogy, I think, you'll pretty quickly realize, I think that's where we are with the Affordable Care Act, with all of the things that are happening in American healthcare, where we're really not looking globally very much. We have no one to help us ferret out some of these issues. And so we're at this, what I would term an event horizon, where we're having a great deal of difficulty sorting out the various pieces of the puzzle. And let me just tell you what some of those issues are. We've got, you know, amazing healthcare, but it's amazing healthcare for the most part in our urban environments. You all know it's very expensive, and I'll show you some of the statistics on that. But despite all of the advances, all of the money that we pour into healthcare itself, typically not preventing disease, but actually curing disease once it occurs, or at least attempting to cure it, we're not the best in terms of life expectancy. If you look at some of the other countries that in fact spend a lot less money, Canada, some of the European nations, and Australia, and Japan, life expectancy is much better in those countries overall. So we're pouring all this money in, but where's the bang for our buck? If you look at life expectancy for men in the U.S., and I'll show women next, what you notice is there's a huge geographic discrepancy. You can see that eastern Kentucky, some of these areas out west and the south, and then pockets here, people are not doing well in terms of life expectancy, and we'll talk a little bit about what's behind that in terms of chronic disease. Nobody really understands this. And if you look at healthcare statistics and compare healthcare costs, there's not a good correlation between the prevalence and the incidence of disease. Those are actually two different things. The amount of money spent on healthcare the overall outcomes, just outcomes in terms of immediate outcomes, midterm outcomes, and then long-term outcomes, which is life expectancy. And then the other thing is, why are women in these areas faring worse than men in terms of life expectancy? There's clearly a sex differentiation there in terms of disease states and life expectancy, yet we don't have good explanations for that. These are several graphs that just take us from about 1900 to the best data we have toward the end of the 20th century. And one of the things that stands out is that it's pretty clear that when somebody was born around 1900, that their life expectancy was much lower than those born than those who lived later. And all that tells us is that neonatal mortality in babies was pretty high then, and if you made it through that initial hump, then your overall life expectancy was about the same. But as we go farther forward in time, the 50s, 60s, you'll notice that these graphs begin to coalesce. And so these are obviously things that insurance companies use to determine what kind of premiums they're going to issue, because these are really actuarial tables. But the other aspect of this is that it's very clear that in 1900, infectious diseases, those by caused by bacterial and fungal pathogens, were quite prevalent and obviously caused quite a bit of mortality. And we very rarely see those today. These are just much rarer events. I think I just lost the pointer here. No, there it is. It's just very dim. So there's been a real change in the spectrum of diseases. There's been a change in terms of how long people live. But incrementally, if you look at this, we have not seen huge increases in life expectancy during this period of time compared to the rapid advances that have occurred in medicine and overall care. I mean, in 1900 or in the 1950s, we didn't have CT scanners. We didn't have laparoscopic surgery, minimally invasive surgery, and yet the increases in overall technology have not led to significant advances in life expectancy. So if you look at the sorts of things that we worry about at the U of L in terms of the health science centers and institutes, we worry about these sorts of diseases and the relation to the types of care that we provide and the types of cures that we want to perform, particularly here in the Commonwealth. And these are, I guess I'd call them the signature events that we're dealing with. Now, out of 50 states, Kentucky ranks number 45 overall when you put all these diseases together. So premature birth, smoking, obviously associated with lung cancer, obesity, diabetes, hypertension, stroke, and heart disease are all very prevalent. So why have we not been able to deal with this? Well, the problem is that people, number one, aren't taking care of themselves as a population. And we can tell that by the number of chronic diseases that are occurring. This is a prediction that in terms of millions of Americans, we're going to see about a 50% increase in chronic diseases by 2020 to 2030. Now, the societal impact of that is absolutely astronomical, because if you think about somebody who has heart disease and then drops over a heart attack, that's very sad. We'd like to be able to prevent it, but that's a no-cost event. The person who has chronic angina, pain in their chest from heart disease, they're on 10 different medications, they require bypass surgery, they require all sorts of interventions, they have to go see Dr. Hughes every month, they go get referred, Bob refers them occasionally to a cardiologist. That's exceedingly expensive care. It's not good management, because what we should be doing is preventing the disease to begin with, and unfortunately, we don't know exactly how to do that, but I'll show you some of the things that we're doing at the U of L where we're trying to deal with those issues with innovative new technologies and therapies. So what about the number of people who have chronic disease? So every time you have a chronic disease, you're probably on 3 to 4 different medications. You're seeing your physician more frequently. Well, the current statistics tell us that 25% of the overall U.S. population has one chronic disease. But look at all these other folks who have more than one. The total number of individuals in the U.S. who have more than one chronic disease is actually 25% as well. Now, that's an astounding figure if you think about it, because that means probably not this particular population of individuals, because we've got so many young, healthy folks here. But if you were to go walk out on the street anywhere in the United States, every fourth person you run into has one or more chronic diseases and is on medication and is being treated. And I'm not going to tell you all of the different aspects of this. You can probably figure out many of them for yourself. But one of the major cost centers, if you will, in healthcare is the pharmaceutical industry. And so in the U.S., the pharmaceutical industries make billions of dollars just in antibiotics. The overall antibiotic economy is about $8 billion a year. But if you think about every chronic disease, everybody's on 3 to 4 medications. That's one of the many reasons why our healthcare costs are so high. And here they are. Here's the other aspect, because remember, our life expectancy is not particularly great in terms of other developed countries. So we're not at the top, but guess what? Our healthcare spending is. And so healthcare spending is now, even though it's temporarily, and I hopefully not temporarily, but it has, at least in terms of the figures, leveled off for the first time in ages, it's still approaching 17% of GNP. Now, if this were a stock that you could invest in, we ought to all be investing in it. And instead, it's not a stock, it's a cost to society. And so this is the conundrum at baseline that we're dealing with. So we don't have great life expectancy. We've got an increasingly high incidence of chronic disease, and it's all costing us a lot of money. Here's the other aspect that's pretty scary, the predicted healthcare workforce shortages. So physicians such as myself, general surgeons, but I was an academic surgeon. So a surgeon who's practicing out of the community, in the community, general surgeons are increasingly beginning to retire at about age 55 to 60. Now, there are all sorts of reasons cited. It's typically that they're in small practices where they don't have a lot of cross-call coverage. They've got a very busy schedule. Reimbursement has been great for ages, but it's not as great as it used to be. And the paperwork in terms of dealing with Medicare and Medicaid is enormous. So we've got an aging workforce, some of whom are retiring early, and then our physician supply chain physician demand is just completely outpacing the overall number of physicians that we're turning out. So in 2008, nationwide, we were 7,400 short. If we were to look at those life expectancy curves, we've got an aging population. It's not just the physicians who are aging. And now as we hit 2015, there's a predicted dearth of close to 60,000 plus of physicians. And as this gets broken down, there is a widening discrepancy between the number of primary care physicians, the number of specialists, but it's primary care where we're very, very short. This isn't just physicians, though. There's a predicted shortage of close to 500,000 nurses out to 2020 and 2025. Primary care physicians, you can see the number here. So we have a huge pipeline problem as well. Now, think about what I just told you in terms of we're spending enormous amounts of money on health care. We've got an imbalance in terms of the physician and overall health care practitioner workforce. We've got an aging population that has many more chronic diseases than they used to. Well, I don't have a recipe for overnight success dealing with these issues. But my personal feeling is that there needs to be a readjustment in terms of legislation dealing with some of these issues related to the pharmaceutical industry, the costs that are incurred there, as well as dealing with a number of issues related to federally funded healthcare programs, Medicare and Medicaid. Much of that actually is occurring, albeit at a fairly slow pace, through the Affordable Care Act. So the first time the federal government did something sensible in my mind, and I'm not a complete proponent of the Affordable Care Act, but one of the most sensible things that they did was to actually say, we really should insure more people, and if we can insure them and get them, primary caregivers and prevent some of these chronic diseases, we can probably save money that way. They also did something which is called ERA High Tech. It's part of the 2009 bill, so that healthcare professionals could get into the 21st century technologically with electronic health records, e-prescribing, all the sorts of things that should diminish overall costs of healthcare and should increase access to healthcare, in particular preventive care, and provide inducements for physicians to use these programs. So the cost of an electronic healthcare record installation per physician is about $42,000. And if people, physicians began buying those and installing them in 2010, it actually would pay for itself by 2015. So that was an inducement that made a lot of sense. What we're trying to do in the Academic Health Science Center venue is deal with some of these problems, and I'll talk to you about how we're dealing with it, with some of them with a partnership with a very large health system that has reach across the entire Commonwealth, but more importantly, deal with some of the workforce pipeline issues. As part of that, we do a lot of research, and it's clear that to deal with many of these problems, we need to come up with innovative strategies to either prevent them, and prevent them not just at the individual patient level, but at the populational level through a school of public health, but also innovative treatment mechanisms. So I've said Academic Health Science Center a bunch of times, and Bob introduced me as the Executive Vice President for Health Affairs. Usually I get a blank look when I tell people, well, that's my title. Well, what do you do? And what's an academic health center? There's actually been a study that was done. It was a survey dealing with a number of individuals who, you know, were lay people, and they were asked, what's an academic health center and what value do you think it provides? They had no clue. About 20% of them said, well, I think that's something to do with a medical school. And in fact, that's what really resonated with people because, in fact, it is. It is an accredited medical school associated with a teaching hospital and then one or more health professional schools. Now, academic health centers range from very small ones to extremely large ones. Some of the larger ones I've worked in, here's one right here, University of Minnesota, has a very large series of programs there. Our programs at the U of L are very expansive as well. So our health science center has four different schools: dentistry, medicine, nursing, public health, and information sciences. As is true at most health science centers, medicine is the largest. We also have 14 centers and institutes, and I'm just going to show you the panoply of institutes here. Each of these is fairly specialized in what they do, but to point out two of them, the Institute for Cellular Therapeutics, you may or may not have read about this, but that institute has a startup company, Regenerex, and the startup company, in association with the U of L, just linked what could be a multi-billion dollar deal in the long run with Novartis, one of the largest big pharmas in the world. We also have the James Graham Brown Cancer Center, which has quite a bit of brand name recognition. And we have an Institute for Molecular Cardiology, just to name a couple of these, where some really groundbreaking work is being done. The Spinal Cord Injury Research Center, if you went on CNN, Courier Journal, USA Today, headlines today with in terms of spinal cord regenerative work. We are in an urban environment. It's a very densely packed environment in terms of healthcare because we've got affiliates with Kentucky One Health now managing our university hospital, with the exception of the Center for Women and Infants. And that's, they now own Jewish Hospital, Fraser Rehab Institute. We've got folks at Norton with whom we deal, sometimes nicely, sometimes not, in terms of their view of the U of L. And then we've got affiliations with Baptist Healthcare and the VA as well. I will tell you, just on a brief personal note, right about here, you can see over on the wall, is my favorite view coming down into downtown Louisville on River Road. It's an absolutely panoramic view of the downtown area and one of the bridges there. This is a virtual tour, which we'll go through pretty quickly. This is the old county hospital. It's the old general hospital. It's now where I have my office, so I'm in the one of the oldest buildings there. You know, we've renovated it. But we've got a mix of old and brand new construction. This is our Center for Translational Research that's absolutely state-of-the-art. If we could, we need two more of these. And I'd love to be able to find the federal and state funds as well as philanthropy to help with this. This was just recently named the COSAIR Charities Translational Institute, Clinical and Translational Institute, because the amount of support that group has provided us, not just for pediatric research, but really support for infrastructure of all sorts. This is our fairly new outpatient building, which has state-of-the-art clinical facilities. It also currently houses our clinical trials group. Interesting architecture in terms of the public health building, which is also reasonably new. And then some of our buildings, which quite frankly look really nice on the outside, but need to be renovated extensively to bring them up to specs for 21st century scientific research. University Hospital and the James Graham Brown Cancer Center. This facility is being renovated in a number of areas on the inside. And interestingly, the Cancer Center, if we ever are able to, could support about four more floors next to it. So we could really expand quite a bit. And then just one more view of some of the buildings on campus there. So what do we look like in terms of a snapshot? Well, the all funds budget is a little over $500,000. Jim Ramsey came up with an absolutely brilliant strategy. I mean, he's a PhD economist. He's worked in state government as a state budget director. And I'd never heard of tax increment financing. But we're now going on our third TIF, and essentially the federal government, local municipalities, really across the nation, if they wish to do it, can set up programs so that if you provide an economic stimulus, you bring businesses in, you bring people in, you bring more jobs in, a portion of the taxes generated from that can be shared with the entity that promises to do that. And so we're currently hitting about $5 to $6 million on the downtown TIF, which is the Health Science Center TIF. And that's now been activated for a year and has 30 years duration on it. And so the more people and jobs we bring in, the more taxes that are generated, the more we'll see this come back so that we can do more in turn. We're about ready. Bob, can we tell them about the campaign? We're pretty darn close to our goal of $1 billion. So we're pretty happy with that. And health sciences has been a significant part of that. And I don't take credit for that. That's before my time, although we've had some pretty good wins over the last 3 years. One of the other things that has been a major initiative of mine And I don't take, again, I don't take credit for it, but I've been in a leadership position to help manage it. We have about 600 physicians who practice and teach and do research at the U of L. When I came there, there were 17 different practice groups, all using different billing systems, not referring to each other internally, no electronic health record. But a couple of years before that, there were 76 practice plans. That's like the Wild West if you're an administrator trying to figure that out and trying to put an all-funds budget together. We've now coalesced into a single practice plan, University of Louisville Physicians. We're putting in a back-end billing office, a claim scrubber, which is something that makes sure your claims go through seamlessly electronically to the health plans, because if there's a single digit off in the patient's address or a social security number, they love bumping them right back to you. And this group is increasingly doing very well. Prior to our partnership with Kentucky One, this is what University of Louisville Hospital or University Medical Center looked like. And if you put this together, the whole Health Science Center budget is about $1 billion a year. I talked about jobs. I think one of the major keys to dealing with all of the panoply of problems that I told you about in terms of not just workforce, but how do we deliver better care, more efficient care, and see quality improve, is the job pipeline. And so I see that as one, if not our major role, in dealing with this societal problem. And so dentistry, we see close to 500 students, number of residents, medicine, very large faculty, 600 practicing physicians, but we've got a lot of basic scientists also. And then close to 650 students, residents in training who will be coming out after 3 years as family practitioners or internists, a little bit longer for some of the surgical disciplines, but a lot going on in terms of that pipeline. Now, one of the problems with that pipeline is that we are highly regulated by the federal government through the Medicare program, because Medicare is tied directly into what we call graduate medical education funding. And fortunately, there are bills on the House floor right now by some, I would say, progressively minded elected officials who realize that no matter how much the U of L Health Science Center wants to increase that medical student and resident pipeline to get those physicians out and practicing to take care of all these people who are now insured under the Affordable Care Act, we don't have the money to do it. And so there's a bill underway to increase GME training slots across the U.S. by 70,000. I don't know if that's the right number or not, but at least it's not 7,000. I think it's a pretty good number. We've got a great school of nursing and a great school of public health, and I'll just mention that we have fairly new deans for both public health and medicine. Dr. Craig Blakely and Dr. Tony Ganzel, who are doing an absolutely superb job. One of the things that we always track very carefully on is our research funding. NIH funding has been flat and is being cut now. And I consider this another very significant societal issue, because we've got former third world countries, India, China, pouring money into research and their health science center research, just pouring it in. And my greatest fear with what's happened with the NIH budget, and I think it's actually already partially been realized, is that when I came up through training, I was a gunner, but I can tell you that I was a gunner who got my funding early on and got lots of it, but there are lots of other gunners out there today who aren't getting funded at all, and we may lose a generation of physician scientists because of that. Those are the folks who will create the new discoveries that will help us deal with some of these problems. So we've been doing pretty well in terms of having about $100 million dollars in research. If the NIH budget were where I think it should be, and I realize that there are all sorts of financial exigencies, we'd probably be at about $180 million, not $100 million. Some of the stars that we've got, I just want to highlight a few things to tell you what happens at a health science center, which is different than what might happen in other areas of clinical care and medicine. Many of the physicians are physician scientists, and they move from seeing patients in the clinic and the bedside to doing what I did for 25 or so years, going to my research laboratory and thinking about that patient I just saw and how a new discovery might solve the problem that that patient or a whole bunch of patients with that problem might have. My particular area was dealing with transplantation and also infectious disease, as Bob mentioned. But Don Miller, who heads up the Cancer Center, looking at new drug discovery, new ways of treating cancer. Just about every single anti-cancer agent that we have on the market right now went through some sort of process like this. Some investigator saying, I wonder if this works. And maybe it'll work in an animal model. Maybe we can move it into clinical trials. And all of a sudden, the pipeline's about 7 to 10 years long for that, by the way. But all of a sudden, we've got a new therapeutic agent. You may have heard about Roberto Bolli's work. In essence, he's taking patients who can't even walk upstairs because they've had so many heart attacks or they've got some type of heart disease that their heart is so weakened that it won't pump enough blood. And they can barely move around. And he's taking a biopsy, so a sample of their heart tissue, and growing it with stem cells and then re-injecting it back into the damaged heart tissue. We've got a couple of people who have undergone this therapy who come to our presentations and tell people how they couldn't walk upstairs, and now they're walking around like normal folks where they can... and we've got a number of studies that show that this works. We're now setting up our own, what's called a best manufacturing practice facility to do this and do this in as many patients as we can. Neurosciences Institute, and I'm just going to jump to Susie Harkema's work. This is what was on headlines yesterday and today. She's got patients who have completely transected spinal cords, and it appears that the spinal cord has a brain of its own memory, which you can retrain. And so people who typically are in wheelchairs, completely unable to move, they're now walking, often unassisted. And she's got about 9 of these patients now, and we're expanding it into a pediatric population. So let me just go to the third part of this and then finish up. Health science centers, and in particular our university medical center, often are safety net hospitals. In fact, UMC has a 25% indigent patient ratio. Now, what does that mean? That means that 25% of the people who receive absolutely state-of-the-art care there can't pay a cent. And that all gets written off. It gets supported by some of the trust funds. And that's why when I got a call from a headhunter and they told me what was going on down here in 2011, you know, I said, boy, that's a pretty interesting dynamic where you've got a big health science center searching for a health system partner trying to engage in a full asset merger. And make itself a lot better and a lot bigger with a lot of resources that would be brought in. Well, needless to say, after a little under six months, on December 28th, 2011, when we heard the governor's pronouncement that UMC was a public asset and that it couldn't be consolidated into a private entity, albeit a not-for-profit, many of our hopes were at least temporarily dashed. because at that point I was going to have a bank account that had $200 million in it, plus probably another $120 million for infrastructure. That's a pretty big chunk of change, and that's what we were counting on spending and investing. Well, rather than throw in the towel, we went back and said, well, we really need to explain to people why we think we needed to do this. And I don't take credit for it. As a matter of fact, I think the person who really drove the merger was President Jim Ramsey. And that's pretty amazing as an economist to come up with that. It was I went on record as saying, you know, I dealt with a university hospital acquisition by a very large health system in Minneapolis, and 5 years of pain and torture trying to deal with maintaining the university in a way that it was, you know, really thriving. A six-hospital full-asset merger in Buffalo that actually went sideways because of GASB 45 issues, retirement fund issues, with a public benefit corporation. And I went on record as saying this is the best deal I'd seen. And Jim gave me the reins to finalize it, got halted. We decided we better explain to people why we thought this was important. Here's what UMC looked like in terms of its operating margin in 2012. 2.5% isn't bad. As a matter of fact, if you're doing, you know, 1-2% operating margin for a safety net hospital these days, you're okay. But here's what was predicted going forward. Absolutely no way of getting out into capital markets, getting, you know, rebonded for renovations, new construction, and this and that. So essentially, UMC was going to be dead in about 3 to 4 years if we didn't do something. What we did was, and this is something that I had experience with in New York. By the way, New York, in case you don't know, is not the Empire State, it's the Umpire State. Everything is overregulated there. And so one of the things that we did a lot of were requests for proposals, so essentially a bid process. But in New York, we often did it as a competitive bid process, not just a flat RFP. So we asked the powers that be, could we do another go-round and issue an RFP and seek a health system partner? And the answer was yes. As a matter of fact, it was a resounding yes from both Governor Beshear and Attorney General Conway. They said, we understand you need a health system partner, cast your net more widely. They thought this was a good idea in terms of the process. We weighted it so that we could have some parameters up front and be able to actually score the proposals after competitively bidding these. This is just what it looked like, pretty detailed, went through the state procurement process. And then we had a consulting firm come back, make it very clear that what the finances at UMC were going to look like in 3 to 4 years. Bob was a strong supporter of the entire initiative, along with Frank Minifield, the former board chair, and others. And essentially, both the U of L Board of Trustees and the UMC Board of Directors voted to issue a joint RFP. We got two proposals. We went through competitive negotiations. There was a bit of noise in the press about why we extended the deadline for a final bid process to be selected, that we didn't have any bidders. The answer was no, the competitive process was going extremely well, and in fact, we wanted to prolong it to get the best bid possible. Kentucky One Health ended up being the partner we selected. And I'll show you a little bit of why and show you a little bit of the background behind what we negotiated. So Kentucky One has, as Bob mentioned, about 80 primary sites. They've got a number of smaller sites, but they're all over the Commonwealth here. So what did this give us in one fell swoop. It gave us a primary care network, and it gave us reach across a large part of the Commonwealth, which we didn't have before. We have literally no primary care network at the U of L. We're mainly a tertiary care center. So it gave us this reach. We had a lot of mission and vision alignment. In other words, when we said, we hope you're not afraid of the safety net nature of UMC with a 25% indigent care population, Kentucky One Health, sponsored by Catholic Health Initiatives and the Jewish Heritage Fund for Excellence, said, well, that's what we do. That's our core mission. Of course, we're not afraid of that. The other aspect of this is that we had very strong programs at Jewish in Fraser downtown. Selecting another entity would have most likely disrupted those long-term relationships. We've got our entire cardiovascular services there, neurosciences, transplant. And so that would have been a real truncation of those relationships. So that was one of the major factors that came into play. We did what's called a discounted cash value analysis. And essentially what this says is that upfront money's worth more than money downstream 20 years later. And you have to discount it for what's actually committed by contract versus what is potentially going to be earned through a series of parameters, such as we make system performance better, and then you get a virtual payment, for example. But the whole deal over 20 years was close to $1.4 billion. Some of the other factors that I mentioned, they did have the higher score in the RFP process. That was, you know, a major factor. This is what I just mentioned in terms of the cohesion at essentially a downtown academic medical center. And then this is a very interesting sidelight to this, if you will. But we said, well, you know, one of the things the governor has asked us to do is make sure that if certain things don't occur, that either the U of L can unwind the whole transaction or the governor can step in and do it. And we said, we have to have a way of getting our assets back. We have no way of doing that unless we can get financing. So we actually convinced them to do the financing, and we would be competitors at that point. So it's an interesting little sidelight to it. The way we structured this is a joint operating agreement, and one of the issues that continued to rear its head through the merger discussions was the issue of women's health and women's care. So we retained the entire third floor of the hospital with the neonatal intensive care unit, where all the deliveries, C-sections occur, all of that. Kentucky One manages the rest of UMC, and the UMC board has significant reserve powers over this entire process. The total investment over years 1 to 3 would be $135 million. And then I already mentioned this note. So this was not as much as we had before, but it's not a full asset merger. And so that was the reason it wasn't the $200 million. Here's the breakdown in terms of this. This is the $135. And then this was a very significant aspect of this. So if you have 600 academic physicians practicing at a series of facilities, they have salaries, they have on-call pay, they get paid for a variety of duties such as medical directorships, managing the schedule in the operating room. All of that totaled across the entire platform at UMC, Jewish, and Fraser, $75 million a year. We fixed that in stone for the first 5 years, and then it can fluctuate back to a certain extent, but it can't go down to zero. And if you look at what this amount was, when UMC first came into existence and was managed by, it was a similar joint operating agreement, but managed by another entity, that amount was about $7 million a year. So this was clearly our lifeblood in terms of managing the situation with the faculty and their reimbursement. And then there's a baseline support payment. Without going into a great deal of detail, we also built in a number of equity payments, and these are not currently being realized. We didn't expect that they'd be realized for the first 3 to 4 years. But in essence, if we do things that make Kentucky One hum, we get virtual equity payments, which, if things go really well, out at about year 5, could be as much as $40 to $50 million a year. Now, what are we going to do with that money? We're going to reinvest it in the academic mission. We're going to recruit more faculty. We're going to train more students. We're going to train more residents. We're going to pump fuel into that workforce pipeline. There are a few other things that I'll just go very briefly through. IT upgrades are probably the most costly thing in healthcare today. And so the prediction for what we needed at UMC was $70 million. And then there need to be ongoing recapitalization costs. And they agreed to provide about $21.5 million per year. That's about the number that we had as a plug number for that. Kentucky One has a board of directors, and we have 3 board seats on it, but I can tell you that we have a prominent position because of the partnership relationship. So I sit on 3 different committees. By the way, Bob, they finally gave me governance and nominations, if you can believe that. That's the one we were after. But the UMC board remains in place with these significant reserve powers. Let me just give you a quick example. We built into the transaction documents that Kentucky One can't suddenly say, well, we want to move this type of bed to a different facility, and we want to change this type of bed from med-surg to psych or vice versa. They can't do that if it influences our accreditation. And so a couple of months ago, they announced, without formally discussing it with us, that they wanted to explore converting 10 or 20 adult psych beds at UMC to medical and surgical beds. The latter are more lucrative in terms of overall reimbursement. The only problem was is that we would have lost our adult psychiatry residency overnight over that. So that's where I have veto power, then the UMC board has veto power over certain things like that. We don't get into much of a tussle about that. It's just a matter of understanding where the checks and balances are related to that. And so we're coming up with a different plan to solve that particular problem. So what is the impact on this? And going back to what I discussed at the beginning, what's the overall impact of having a health science center and having a health science center affiliate with a large health system partner? Well, it allows us to recruit and retain high-caliber faculty, to enhance educational opportunities to maintain the educational pipeline, and expand our research enterprise. Now, this latter, remember, if we can do things such as cure heart failure, have people with severed spinal cords walk again, we will be doing our work correctly. And that's one of the many things that we need to strive to do. The resources coming in will allow us to recruit and retain the highest quality faculty. I'm going to skip over a couple of these other things, but suffice it to say that UMC had what was called a closed medical staff previously. The transaction deal potentially opens it up, but what we did was we said, this is a teaching hospital. We'll welcome anybody who wants to come in as long as they'll teach, and they have the appropriate credentials to teach. This is an important issue in an academic medical center where clinical department chairs have the ability, these are academic clinical department chairs, to control the service line in a good way, but to manage it to make sure that the teaching and training expectations are met. And then finally, dealing with significant financial support for growth of the academic programs. We've gone through an arduous investment proposal process with Kentucky One to accrue that $135 million. But this also allows us additional training opportunities throughout the state. The statewide network is something that I would say is not something that will be immediately realized, but we want to populate Kentucky One sites with James Brown Cancer Center clinical sites, clinical trials. And this is what I already mentioned to you. So I think overall, if we look at the opportunities, they're enormous throughout the state in terms of clinical trial activity. And that's not just an academician thinking selfishly about, I'm going to get more patients into clinical trials. It's getting those patients the opportunity to participate in those clinical trials, some of which might save their lives, quite frankly. And then just to summarize, all of the problems in healthcare are not going to be fixed overnight. I think that should be obvious to all of us in the room. But the fact that federal funding for research, clinical trial activity, and the ability to recruit and retain the best and brightest academicians in a health science center has diminished so significantly. Doing a deal like the one I just described provides financial stability to UMC and the U of L for the next 20 years, provides programmatic stability and growth for this foreseeable future, where otherwise we would have been curtailing those clinical trials and probably closing some of our programs. And just in summary, I think it really positions the U of L Health Science Center to be an academic health center of the future. So I'm going to close there. Thank you very much for your attention.